Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Colin McCormick.
And I'm Christy Vogler.
And today we're talking about The Warriors, a 1979 American action thriller directed by Walter Hill and based on a Sol Yurick novel from 1965 of the same name, which is, in and of itself, based on an ancient text by a guy named Xenophon called the Anabasis that I'm sure we'll get into a little bit. But before we jump into the meat, we have two special guests joining us, one repeat, one for the first time. But we've got Joel Christensen here and Tim Girolami, which we're both very excited to have back and for the first time. So welcome, guys. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having us, Colin. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we are down Eli. She got called in. But we're going to start. I'll start with Tim and Joel. I should refer to everyone as boppers, actually. So you boppers, what's your experience? And do you dig this movie?
Tim, can you dig it?
I definitely dig this movie. Yeah, let's
for our podcast.
Do it, boppers. I saw this movie when I was a kid. I grew up in a college town. I grew up in Wesleyan University's town. And we used to go see movies, sneak into movies, basically, that they were screening when I was in high school. And we'd get the flyer of movies, and The Warriors was on there. My older brother, he's about 7 years older than me, so he's a little... He was probably nine when this movie came out, so he's a little too young to have been, like, you know, like, first seen it. But he was like, oh, that's garbage. Don't see that. And I went and saw it. And it was just, like... I think the first time I saw it, it wasn't anything... I don't know what I knew to expect, but it definitely wasn't quite what I expected. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. And then I've seen it... You know, a handful every so often since, other than the period when it seemed to be on cable every day.
Yeah.
It was definitely that period.
So I have Tim almost entirely to thank for my knowledge of this movie. I want everyone to know that he did a shitload of homework after we talked about this movie again. But for the first time I ever saw it, it must have been like 2000 or so. And Tim loves to show up with a bad movie or unknown movie and be like, there's a piece of shit, you gotta watch this with me. So we lived together for 2 years when I was finishing up undergrad and Tim was figuring out what life was going to hold for him, and a lot of it was spent drinking bourbon and water and watching weird movies, and this is not at all the weirdest one that we watched together. If by anything, it's the most functional. So I think there was one night, because we're both classics majors, and The Warriors was there, and Tim was like, I can't believe you haven't seen this, which is how most of our conversations went. And so we watched it, and I was like, yeah, this is okay. And then it had a brief, like, renaissance, like, around 2001 or two, mm-hmm. because somebody came out with a video game based on it. And so I remember I lived in New York at the time and saw the advertisements everywhere. We used to talk about it. And there's those, you know, those two, like, the movie could be summed up in two quotable lines. And first, it's, can you dig it? Right? And the second, of course, is, Warriors, come yep. out to play, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, so, you know, when you asked if I'd come on again, I was like, oh, yeah, I want to talk about this movie, but I got to talk about it with Tim. And so Tim and I watched it together, like, two nights ago. And I have to say that we have very different feelings about the movie right now, because it hasn't aged well. I don't mean since 79. Like, it hasn't aged so well since 2002. And so, like, we're watching it, trying to have fun, but at the same time, we're like, wait, what is happening to us?
Yeah. Christy, was this your first viewing of The Warriors?
Yes, and it was a slightly surreal experience because my partner was apparently a huge fan. Like, when they say it's a cult classic, I started watching it. He's getting ready for work and then comes in with coffee. He's like, The Warriors! And he starts doing the come out to play and everything. And I'm just looking at him. I'm just like, what is happening? And he's like watching the title sequence. It's like, I'm so pumped up for work now. And I think... So that made the first moment really enjoyable up to Cyrus in the meeting, because it's like, okay, this is really exciting. And then he left, and like a hype element left with that. And it reminded me of my best viewing experience ever of the film 300 was when I watched it with the Sigma Chi guys in their fraternity house, the whole group getting together and just, this is Sparta. And that was very much my feeling. It's like, if I was in a room full of men who are like gung-ho excited. Andy was saying, it's like, I tried to have the hair of Swan and the bulk of Swan. And I'm like, okay, I can see being very excited about this film. But eventually watching it as a woman, it got really uncomfortable in some of the scenes too. So it was so much, and I'm sure we'll get into more of it. So I don't think I dig it, but there's a lot I'm excited to unpack with it. So I'll say that.
Yeah, this is, I think I was exposed to this film because my brother-in-law basically was like, he was going on about it, and he's all into, like, you know, sort of cult films, among other things, like New York gangs, which is the part that I really get fixated on, is like the way gangs are depicted in this movie and just gangs in, like, general, like, kind of late 70s, early 80s media. And but his in was like, oh, it's like based on this like ancient text. Have you heard about it? And then it just so happens that the Anabasis, the thing it's based on, was like my very first Greek thing that I, like, when I was in college, and like you finish sort of intro Greek, and there's usually like a couple of things people tend to read. And mine, for me, we read the Anabasis, and then afterwards I learned about this movie. And then now I kind of, even though I, like Christy was saying, there's a lot of parts of it that are weird and have not aged well and sit a little strange and are kind of maybe and are comfortable to watch, but like all that considered, I still kind of unironically dig this movie for various reasons, just because it's so kind of ridiculous. And like Joel was saying, like I just finished watching it like 10 minutes ago. And I was there watching with my partner, and we were like, just even when he does the Warriors lines, like that is such a weird line reading that in 1,000 years, I would have never read the line like that.
It's that guy is so good. I mean, you know, he's the guy from Commando.
Mm-hmm.
Who goes, you know, he's, remember when I said I was going to kill you last?
Yeah.
I remember Matrix. Like, it's like, I don't know. He's really good at being squirrely.
Yeah. And he improvised that line, or at least that's what the internet told me. So, yeah. So I'm not even sure where do we want to start with this one.
Well, I have one thing about that line. So Joel mentioned I was doing homework, right? So I did a lot of homework because I'm a librarian. I don't have to worry about teaching or anything like that. And everything's on audiobook now. So I read The Warriors, the book, finally.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked in interlibrary loan in college, it used to get requested all the time.
Yeah.
Because our university had a copy, and I skimmed it a bunch of times. And I got to say, if you want, if you think women are treated poorly in this movie, don't read the book. Everyone is more realistically awful nihilistically awful anyways. And then I also read the Anabasis, because I'm not sure if I read the whole thing in translation. Of course, I'm not equipped to read it in Greek, but there's actually a section where there are guys calling out to Xenophon by his name in book 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, I mean, it's gotta be improv. I don't think it's actually related, but it was pretty funny to read, like, what does they say? Still others would be setting the house on fire, meanwhile calling Xenophon by name and bidding him come out and be killed. So I'm like, that's damn close.
Yeah.
Even though I'm sure it's a total coincidence.
maybe we should just start there, right? Just for listeners, probably for most of our listeners and just most people who are not intimately familiar with this text, which has a kind of a strange place, not a strange place, it has a place in like the annals of Greek literature, but basically is part journal, part account of this guy named Xenophon, who basically gets sort of swept up or enlisted or convinced to join this war. And he goes along with about 10,000 other Greek mercenaries who basically get involved in like a civil war / coup that's happening in Persia between the king and his younger brother, Cyrus, namesake for the gang leader. And then sort of in the event, sort of in this battle in about, I think 401, at least that's what the movie told me, 401 BC, the sort of Persians that the Greeks were sort of working for get killed. The Greek leaders end up getting executed at this like kind of Red Wedding style dinner. And then the rest of the first four books, which is the part that most people read, even though there's a couple of other books afterwards, is about the Greeks trying to sort of fight their way out of the sort of Persian heartland and make it back to the sea. And so the transposition here is the warriors have to fight their way down from the Bronx, Van Cortlandt Park, which also is a part of the reason I love this movie, is because I used to do cross-country meets in Van Cortlandt Park when I was in high school. But they fight their way down from the Bronx all the way back to Coney Island with every gang and cop in New York after them. I think that's the gist of it, right? Am I missing anything?
Yeah, I will say that I was also fascinated. So like halfway through the movie when gang fight after gang fight is happening, I started reading the background on the film itself and like what it took to make it, which was fascinating in and of itself. But one of the things I thought was interesting is that the book was written in reaction to West Side Story, because the author was actually really angry with gang depictions in New York from West Side Story. So he was trying to, you know, tell a more realistic version of that. And I think going back to just my earlier comment, like the things that were happening with women in the story, like made me uncomfortable, but I also appreciated like that was super authentic for, you know, how scary is it for a woman to be out at night on the streets by herself? And like, what kind of treatment would she receive? And to me, it's like, it's not that it doesn't age well. It's just that like, oh, that resonates, because that still speaks to fears that you have, at least as a woman. I don't know necessarily about gang violence and what the experience of that is in New York City, but I thought that was interesting that the author's intention was really to actually show what gang violence in New York was like more realistically than West Side Story. So,
and I think the movie enters into a weird place then. Tim and I were talking about this the other day, because it definitely has the aesthetic of those late 70s, early 80s New York is rotting films. Right. And like the palette and the scenes make me think of the original Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, or some of the like shots made me think of Death Wish, the first one in New York. So there's that. But then on the other hand, like there are parts of it that are lit and costumed like a musical, right? Like I'm looking at the original script right here on my other screen, and they do. It's actually more trying to be like Greek in some way, like tragic, than the movie ended up to be. And there's a catalog of all the gangs, and like the like ability, like the desire to make a realistic movie, like which filled with homophobia, filled with misogyny, it's a dangerous place, right? To do that, but also have these gangs, the xylophones. There's actually a Xenophon gang in the script, the Saratoga, the Savage Huns, who are the Queensbridge mutilators, the Knuckles, the Locos, the Meatpackers. I mean, this list, this catalog itself, you could do just a podcast of this list. Charlemagne's. I mean, it's mad. So for me, I mean, I think maybe part of the cult resonance of the film is it's in a really weird place tonally, right? Like it's all over the place.
Yeah, because you get, I mean, the thing about that defines gangs kind of in this movie is that their commitment to really strong theming, right? That like, you know, as like in the first sort of scene, as you sort of are cutting in between, or like the opening credits, as you're cutting in between the warriors talking about the meeting that's coming up and then the various gangs like assembling, like, it is very much like a catalog, which like, you know, Greek literature loves to do their lists and catalogs of ships and warriors and heroes. And even cuts back around at the end, like when the credits roll, most of the actors, aside from the individually named actors, they're just sort of listed under, it's like the Riffs and then a list of names and then the Punks, etc. That they exist in these like almost like tribal identities.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because that's definitely added in like the 65 book. It has some of the gang names laid out, but it's nowhere near as many. And they're not as fanciful like the main gang. They're called, there's the Delancey Thrones, and then like they're the Coney Island Dominators. So I mean, it's Coney Island the Warriors, you know, it's not that far off. But I think it almost reminds me more of, if you go way back in New York gang history to the 19th century, some of their names are very outlandish. I think Hi-Hats is the mime gang in this, and I feel like Hi-Hats might actually be the name of a like 1860s street gang too,
like Dead Rabbits.
I think they had, I mean, Gangs in New York, the Scorsese movie, that's based off a book called Gangs in New York. Like it brings in that too. And I think there's some of that influence in there. It always amazes me, or it doesn't amaze me, but like if you look, it also is kind of what I think one of the ways this movie was influential. If you look forward, you got Escape from New York has a little bit of that, of the outlandish gangs and everything. But some of the Italian knockoffs that come in, like 1990, The Bronx Warriors, definitely it takes this outlandish costume stuff even further and makes the musical connection you're talking about even more apparent, I would say. But looks like they came off of a cabaret or something or chorus line. They have like sparkly bowler hats.
Yeah, like one of the gangs, their uniform is like purple sequins vests.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, but the sequin vest almost makes sense compared to like the guys in the pinstripe based uniforms and the makeup.
Yes.
Like what's going on with that crew?
I asked this exact question as I was watching it. Yes, like I understand almost like wanting to dress like baseball players, but on top of that, the like very like elaborate, almost like zombie like face paint that they've got going on.
I was just going to say that was actually based off a real New York gang too. The Baseball Furies were apparently based off Second Base, which was an earlier gang that was inspired by baseball garb. So,
but they didn't do Kiss face paint, right?
No, okay. It was based on Kiss. It was based on Kiss for the inspiration of their look.
Okay. Like, you had a good point, Jill, when we were watching it about Clockwork Orange, because I had never considered that before as an influence on this.
Well, I mean, just so the unbridled youth violence and so that surreal aspect to it, again, with the lighting and some of the set, it made it seem like you're in that sort of liminal space that's not just night. But the whole thing, like the traveling motif and the movement from one territory to the other, if we want to take it seriously as a literary form, made me think of ethnography and not actually Greek ethnography. I was actually thinking that there's a mediocre Isaac Asimov book, which probably describes most of them, but his Prelude to Foundation has this section where this character is going through these different layers of this really built up planet, and each one has like a different civilization in it, and sort of a rapid ethnography. And so for me, like when we watched again, I was thinking, all right, can we see these sort of representations of parts of New York? And then I was like, maybe we should go back in time and we should just drink and do drugs while watching this movie, because that was easier than trying to make sense of it as a real coherent film. No, because like to going back to it, I think there's probably more to talk about in is this really a Greek thing or not? But just like as a whole film, going back, like if somebody asked me what's it about, I would quote, can you dig it? Cyrus's speech at the beginning, warriors come out to play. And then I had suppressed everything else.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot in between. And like, and the climactic scene is barely anything. It's like 2 minutes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they're done.
So that's faithful to the Anabasis, which also just kind of ends. It literally just ends. He's like, yeah. And then we captured this guy and took his money and tried to hand it out. The end.
Because the part that everybody remembers in the Greek is the first four books, which is this great, you know, trials and tribulations until they get to the sea, and it's a great celebration. But then it goes on for like three or four more books of just being a mercenary in Thrace for like a minute.
It made me think how this movie, like the world these guys are living in. I mean, I wonder if Sol Yurik there wasn't inspired by that a little bit, because the world these guys are living in, it's constant conflict. There's no end, right? The real street gangs that he knew, like they have no future ahead of them except more of this. And I feel like these mercenaries that are under Xenophon, it's not that far off. If you read those last three books, it's just like they go from one place to another, getting screwed over by people trying to pay them, and then like fighting another group of people, killing a bunch of more random. These Thracians, man, they must have really hated the Greeks. That's all I got to say, because the Greeks are just like, we need plunder, so we're just going to go raid your villages now. Like, they're just awful. Which, also, Sol Yurik's the warriors. The warriors are just awful. The gang rape that is threatened in the movie happens in the book. That character is not a real character. She's just a mouthy woman in one scene. And then they murder a guy who tries to intervene, if I remember right, or he speaks up or something. And then they're just on the run again. So it's like... And they don't come home to they aren't ever accused of killing Cyrus. Like, that's not a plot thread. They just, that goes bad. That meeting goes bad, and they're trying to get back. And they get home, and they're back in their horrible hovel. And, you know, the guy, the lead character's mother is having sex with her boyfriend, and his brother, who's on drugs, is in his bed with his sister sleeping. And they're, you know, the one bed that they have in the apartment that's not being used. And that's the end. I mean, that's a spoil a whole book. I don't know how many people have access to this. I had to get it through interlibrary load. So it's not, you know, commonly just floating around out there. I think you could buy probably a copy, but it's I don't know. It's bleak. Anyways, the movie has a little bit more, I think, you know, there's that chance of escape they talk about at the end. So there's a hope.
Yeah. And so like, you just reminded me of two things, which is like, one, like, Joel was saying, like how much of this movie that I've sort of suppressed. And like, I completely forgot entirely about the whole scene. It's, I guess, like the penultimate scene where they're on the train and like the prom kids or whoever they are come onto the train and they're just staring at each other. And there's very much like, and I think it's kind of one of the better scenes in the movie, but you just see exactly like the seeing another life that you just can't have because they're just sort of stuck. And then Mercy has a whole speech about like why she does. Because earlier I was just kind of remarking, like, Mercy to me is one of the more perplexing characters, because like I'm trying to even understand, is she a character or is she just like a device? But she gives that whole speech that's just like, I do this and I'm just kind of chasing the next thing all the time because like this is a bleak, harsh, cyclically violent existence that I don't think I'm ever going to get out of. But the other thing I was going to say, which is that like the morality of this movie is a little funny, right? Because there is like, the movie does kind of have a sense of morality where like Ajax, the mouthiest, most violent agitator in the group, you know, he gets a sort of like just end where he tries to assault that woman in the park and it turns out she's a cop, or like, you know, people are like punished for sins in this movie at least. Or like, the main rogue guy, the guy who, the squealy.
Yeah, which he gets his comeuppance.
Yeah, exactly. People do get their comeuppance.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the moment that you spoke to, about, Cullen, about the prom kid scene, because that also really resonated with me as just this moment where so much was said in relative silence, in what had been a very hectic kind of movie overall. And it was not only like them staring at each other for comparison, but there's a moment where Mercy goes to like fix her hair, mm-hmm. and Swan stops her as if to reassure her, like, you do not have to live up to like what they look like. You like it was so interesting that was a fairly quiet moment. And it does go back to this, what Joel said about like ethnography of like, all of a sudden you get a sense of, you've been in this story with all of these gangs and you've been along for this ride. And then the prom kids show up and it's a moment of observation. And at least for me personally, it's like, you kind of realize, oh, I'm on the prom kid side of things. I have no idea what this life is like.
Yeah.
You know, just seeing them for that moment with a almost more of an eat, and it pans down to look at her shoes where she's like wearing high heels, but they're really dirty. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, that was such a beautiful shot. And then it just kind of goes on from there. And mm-hmm. I think the only other thing that follows up is the boutonniere that he picks up to give to Mercy, and being like, I don't want things to go to waste. Cause mm-hmm. it was still beautiful, even though it had been discarded, it was still something that had value for them. And
we didn't talk about that scene when we watched it, Tim. But I felt like that was clearly sort of, you know, metaphor for his treatment of her, like taking her out of Swan's treatment of Mercy, right? Mm-hmm. Taking her away from the orphans with the lamest gang in New York City, right? They didn't even get invited.
It's hard to be tough when you're led by David Schwimmer. I mean.
No. And then he takes her down. And what's weird is the morality that Swan tries to impose on her. Like, they're in the subway, they're running away, and she's like, let's get it on now. He's like, no. I don't remember what he said, but I think like, if there's something we could identify about the movie working, apart from the kitschiness, it's that the main character's enigmatic, right? Mm-hmm. That Swan mm-hmm. figure. And I think maybe it's because maybe he's not a great actor and they don't give him much to do, or maybe not, right? But he's got an imposing, chiseled face. Right, he's in good shape, he's clean, right, all this stuff. But he doesn't, like, and he's got strong looks, right, steely gaze, but you have no idea what's going on behind his eyes, right? They try to set up, like, a conflict between him and Ajax, and it just comes out like Ajax is an asshole, right? Yeah. Right? And then you just think, what's going on with this guy? And the main characterization we get of him, besides that he's tough, is that he has these expectations of this random woman he just picked up from another gang. So I thank you, Christy, for reminding me of that boutonniere scene, because it was so odd.
It is kind of taken from the book of the 65 book, but there the lead guy is named Hinton, and he's sort of like, I forget what the graffiti marking guy. He's sort of that character mixed mm-hmm. with Swan. If that character was a little bit more like Swan, like, but he still had that like. He was the marker, so he must have some kind of creative impulse, right? So he's kind of that kind of character. But he walks through the subway and gets all dirty, and I think he comes across some prom kids. But he doesn't have – there's no woman with him. There's no other character to bounce off. So they definitely changed up a bit. I do – like Walter Hill, who directed this, I mean, I feel like most of his movies, women usually are – a lot of them, they're prostitutes. So I feel like it's weird. Like, I wonder if he's putting that riff in there, I guess, is my question. Like, if that's sort of his, like, the, you know, the, I have my morality, my code. And he, because he does that kind of thing a lot too. Morality and codes are big in Walter Hill movies. But I think another thing that's interesting is the guy who gets thrown into the subway and killed.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be the love interest, that actor. Mm-hmm. And then he had issues with the production, with the director or something. I didn't quite read through this trivia point, but I was surprised to read that. So, I wonder if that's part of how Swan is as enigmatic as he is, if that was, it's all by design, or how much of it's just the way the production went.
My other thought is also might be it's like it's part of the genre and times, right? Because I think about this movie as, even though it came out in 1979, for whatever reason, I think about this movie as like as an 80s movie. And I'm not entirely sure if that's accurate or fair or why I'm thinking that. But like, as I think of like 80s action stars, they tend to be a little like, if you take them out of the plot, then there's, you know, they tend to be a little generic. But I mean, that's most male action stars, or at least for a time. But
I think that goes back to Westerns. I mean,
that's how we've talked about Greek heroes are actually fairly generic in that way. And yeah, Tim, to your point, like Westerns are very, it's focused on the morality, not so much as the individual development of character.
Yeah, which I guess sort of, it leads me to another question, which is, you know, so the interesting, like, I don't know, I think I watched the director's cut, I think, where they've added this sort of bit in, but where they have the like preface about the battle and the sort of source material. And like, what is the, like, well, why frame the movie in this way? Because aside from the general plot of just a group of guys trying to fight their way home through hostile territory, to my mind, that's basically where the comparison with the Anabasis kind of ends. But just even on the first point, like Xenophon, the sort of narrator, author, and hero of the Anabasis, is nothing like any of these guys.
No, yeah. And not in the book either. And in the book, you have this device of this character, Junior, who's like the youngest of them. He's reading a comic book adaptation of the Anabasis. So like the sea is in there.
Yeah.
And Sol Yurik has an afterword to the book, a version, the edition I read, and he kind of semi-states, kind of implies more that he did it to make it get attention. He's like, well, Ulysses, no one would read Ulysses if it didn't have that connection to the Odyssey, which I was like, I'm not sure that's true, Sol, but it's an interesting point. It probably helped.
If they'd named Ulysses like Thomas, it may not have gotten the same sort of.
That's probably, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a good point, Tim. No, but the whole idea of like forcing an illusion on someone that doesn't fit, right? And then creating meaning that way. Right? It's a stunt, right?
Yeah.
But is it I know that, you know, Joyce's Ulysses is more engaged with the Odyssey and stuff. But the last time I was on this podcast, we were talking about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, right? And it's clear that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou isn't really based on the Odyssey in like a strict sense, but it's closer to it just sort of thematically and structurally than The Warriors is to Anabasis, which I find interesting, right? Because again, it's just sort of like classical illusions floating in the air. Is it just that it gives it legitimacy some way? Or is it sort of a trick to get us talking about it?
Well, it worked. I mean, here we are.
I do think that there's some bits, like, again, this might be more in the book, because in the movie, when they're in the cemetery, it's kind of brief, right? They're in the cemetery. They're kind of in disarray. Their leader has been killed. In the book, that scene's longer. And it reminded me of the part when Xenophon comes forward, right? Like, the Greek leaders have all been killed, which I didn't know was coming. So when I was listening to that, man, I was like, oh man, I don't think we must not have listened to that, read that part when I was assigned it, or I forgot. It's been 25 years. But, you know, the same kind of thing. They're in disarray, and they actually have an election of the leader in the book. And there's Ajax has a different name. The characters are named differently, but they sort of Ajax analog. It definitely wants to be the leader. And everyone else is like, no. Oh, his name is Lunkhead. That's right. No one wants Lunkhead to be in charge, because the name tells it all, right? But so there's this like quarreling over leadership. I do think the book has a little bit more in there that doesn't, you get little hints of it in the movie, but they had to streamline it to, you know, make it 90 minutes and add in all those fights, because there's really no fights in the book either. There's not descriptions of like running battles. It's interesting. it's much more they, you know, they do come into contact with people and they have conflict, but it's not a, I guess it's not a visual medium, I guess, in the same way. It wouldn't be, you know, they got to make it action-y. So,
well, that's why it's like, I wonder, like, what, you know, if we could go to them back and listen to executives pitching and taking this film, who is their audience, right? And so their audience are people, I think, largely who don't live in New York, right? It's this fantasy of this big, bad city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, and also like the fantasy of like, particularly like you mentioned, like Escape from New York, like particularly in the late 70s, 80s, where New York has this reputation as this like decrepit, crumbling, you know, it's like Gotham in the Batman verse, right? Where it's just like rotting from the inside and the outside simultaneously. And it's beyond saving. Or like, you know, to bring it back to Greek stuff, like it's like Thebes. That's almost like, you know, for Athenian literature, they look next, not that this is very base, but like all these stories about this like Thebes, this like cursed city where all this bad stuff happens. I mean, even just to being sort of very generous, like if we're going to force the illusion and the illusion is being made on us, like there is something about the, like what the movie is doing that's somewhat in dialogue, I think, with Xenophon, where it's like in Xenophon, the main thing is like every time they, every sort of stage, the Greeks like encounter some new people or enemy or obstacle, and they have to figure out some kind of solution. And it's like a lot of the book is about them trying to like adapt to problems as they encounter them, like whether it's the these horse archers that are harassing them or these guys up on these hills rolling boulders on them, or I'm trying to remember other sort of scenes from the apps, but stuff like that. And like there's a kind of an element of that here where like they have different strategies and different gangs have kind of a different angle, whether it's the baseball guys where they kind of pull like a pincer move on them, or the Lizzies. The Lizzies, cool. or with the punks in Union Square.
And I think there's a shared space then for the movie and for the analysis, which is that it really adapts to sort of the linear game mentality, right? Mm-hmm. As a piece of IP, right? You get to explore different places, go against different challenges, right? There's a clear goal and ending. Like Xenophon's analysis is in part a successful text because of the ethnographic, but also because it's bounded. Right, there's a clear goal at the end and outcome, and it's pretty interesting. Looking upon it this time, one of the first things, and Tim, I can't believe you didn't mention it yet, that we were looking at in the film, there's another way to think about it, if we can make up just things that they have in common, is the cultural blending, right? Because that's sort of what's amazing about the Xenophon's analysis, and even Xenophon even being there fighting in a Persian civil war. When we teach Greek literature, and you brought up 300 later, we teach it as this dichotomy of civilizations collapsing. But if you actually read Greek history, like Persia was involved in the Peloponnesian Wars, like in the Theban hegemony, and everything going on, they're all intermingling and playing each other constantly. And so what was different between this book, between the movie and the book, and Tim, you told me this, was how the gangs, some of them were interracial. Right. Mm-hmm. And this sort of moment where Cyrus is there, like trying to bring together all these faces from different places. That was something that I think is a pretty interesting moment. So when I think about sort of the New York fear movies, right, if we're thinking like Death Wish is there on the horizon, right, be afraid and then be a vigilante. The aspiration of the warriors is very different because it starts out with this charismatic leader, right, who wants to unite people, who's then murdered. And I just wonder, as someone, you know, I lived briefly in Washington Heights, you know, not too far off from the Bronx. I mean, how much are we thinking, how much a New York audience is thinking about murdered civil rights leaders, right? Mm-hmm. How much of that is in the background?
I mean, I'd argue, I don't know for sure. You know, I didn't do exit polling on or interviewing people who went and got the, who bought the tickets, but
well, why
this,
not,
this movie, I was two. This movie, had like, I did think it probably had a larger youth audience than like Death Wish. So I worked in a movie theater really briefly as a second job. And I remember, I forgot what movie it came out, but I think it was Honey. And one of the managers called it an urban movie. And I think that's the first time I heard that euphemism. And I was like, oh, but this was an urban movie, right? This was popular in cities. It wasn't just popular in the suburbs. Death Wish is about the fear of these gangs, and it's about a middle-aged guy who goes and takes them out, right? Who gets turned from a pacifist into an aggressive vigilante. This is about, you're right, like it's about they're all played by 30-year-olds, so it's hard to remember that. But they're supposed to be teenagers, and yeah. they had this one charismatic guy who's trying to bring them all together, and then they're trying to survive. But even in the end, like, the Gramercy Riffs are okay guys. They work together. They don't hold a grudge against them. And I think mm-hmm. it's, in a way, it's a more positive view of these guys. And I think it was popular with kids. Theater owners actually started to stop advertising it because there were occasionally problems where they were, or at least highly publicized problems. I think they're mostly a myth. Mm-hmm. There were a few like fights here and there between groups of mm-hmm. people, but they also claimed they had more problems with vandalism. But having worked in a movie theater in Boston, I can tell you that, like, yeah, when the audience was the urban audience, they did tell us, like, oh, this is going to have an urban audience. I forget what that was code for, what we were supposed to do differently. I mean, I was just like, look, this is my second job. I don't care. And I was also like, you guys are being kind of racist right now. You know that, right? But it had that stigma. And I think that's a difference. And that it is more youth focused and it's more positive of them in the end. There are good gangs and bad gangs in a way. It's not like, you know, even Escape from New York, it's a guy from the outside trying to leave. You know, it's not that kind of fight the gangs as much. Yeah.
And I think it's telling, like, speaking of, like, the morality of this film, which is sort of strange and sometimes idiosyncratic, but, like, I think it's telling that, like, the villains are the all-white gang, or, like, the one all-white gang who have, like, a punk aesthetic. I don't know what to call it. Biker?
No, they have rockabilly. A Nazi aesthetic.
Yeah, they're rockabillys with some Nazi insignia. Yeah, they look like 70s greasers. Or maybe motorcycle gang guys.
Yeah. And the Warriors is like a more interracial gang. And then the Riffs also, like you said, sort of end up being sort of good guys. There's kind of like a weird utopianism happening, at least with like Cyrus's first speech, right? Where he's talking about, of course, like Cyrus's utopia is that we can have 60,000 soldiers and then we'll outnumber the cops 3-1 and then we can take over the city.
Apparently that got sounded out originally. Like they were actually worried with the numbers represented of gang members versus cops in New York that they like bleeped it out when it first released in film or in theaters because they were like, oh, we don't want that to be.
I don't know if anyone knows. Was there any truth to that? Was there at any point where we could count gang members or 60,000 gang members?
I didn't do any, I can. If I want to check this off of my reference statistics, I can go look it up. But I think that's probably not inaccurate. But I don't know for sure.
I mean, just speculating on raw numbers, right? Of the city at the time, and you know, in the area, it's 5 to 6 million in it. 100,000 gang members, percentage wise, isn't crazy, right? No, and look at like I have the script here. A modern reading. Defunding the police could be more generous of Cyrus's speech. Because what does he say? He says, one gang could run the city, 100,000 organized boppers. We could run the whole place. Nothing would move. And then he says, we could tax the crime syndicates, the police, because we got the streets, suckers. And that's in capital letters. Mm-hmm. And so at the end, he's talking about controlling the money and imposing order.
Yeah.
Right, which are two things everybody, you know, in the 70s, like the movies are always about decay. There's no money, it's falling apart, and there's disorder and there's crime. And then we have, and again, I don't think we should lose sight of it, that Cyrus, I don't know, I'm not 1979. I don't know if he coded directly as black, but when I was seeing it the other night, I'm like, this is a guy who's somewhat nondescript, right? He's clearly not white, but he could slide into a Dominican gang, right? Where you know, and I think that's important, is that we might be missing out that here we have this young leader. He's a criminal, of course, because he's not white, but he wants to like make the city a safer place to live.
In the book, he's named, Ishmael. What is his last name? I think it's clearly that he's Hispanic or he's multiracial, but now I lost it. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Joel was mentioning a second ago about the like back and forth and the sort of constant contact and involvement sort of across the Aegean between Greeks and Persians and vice and all the different sort of cultures that are in the mix. But like the Greeks, the Cyrus guy that Xenophon, because there's a lot of Cyruses in Persian history, but this one, I forget which Cyrus he is.
The deadest one.
Yeah, the one who gets betrayed and deaded. But he like the Greeks thought pretty highly of, and I think Xenophon like he has a little like biography about him, and they hold these guys up as like model leaders, you know, archetype mm-hmm. leaders that we could study them as like models for leadership.
Mm-hmm. Right. He wrote the Cyropaedia, like the best way to be a leader mm-hmm. is to be a leader like Cyrus, which I always was like, but he died. Friend, like that, and but for people who don't know Xenophon, like Xenophon isn't like a quasi Greek or someone with like lightly Greek loyalties. Like he was so respected that the Spartans gave him an estate, right? Yep. And so this guy, like, he's a serious Greek man, and so I think I'm glad you brought that up, Colin, because it's remarkable. Right. And for us to think of it now, especially post 300 again, where we're all like, oh, the Persians are all bad guys. But like, actually, they're kind of entangled, which again, maybe this means that we missed an opportunity in the movie to have some corrupt cops in the mix. Because what is a 70s crime film without corrupt police officers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that was kind of my takeaway, both watching the film as well as like reading it about its history, because there's some very interesting background to it, was that it was a sympathetic view of these gangs and this life that exists in New York City. Even though it's violent, it was very humanizing in many aspects. And, you know, there's different rumors that go around, but supposedly, like, the director or whoever was working on it wanted local gang members to be involved. So there was, they actually paid a local gang $500 a day to protect the film crew vans. There's one rumor that like Cyrus was actually supposed to be a gang leader, but he disappeared on the day of filming. But others insist like, no, the guy who acted as Cyrus was always supposed to be that. But it was interesting that, you know, this in the production of it, there was an interest in like actually incorporating real gangs or gang culture into the film, not to like make it scarier or grittier, it feels like, but to just again humanize them to an extent.
Mm-hmm. This feels to me like a kind of a warm-up, only because we talked about it just the other week, but it feels to me like a warm-up for The Wire. Yeah. Right, which does some mm-hmm. of that kind of stuff. Like a lot of the cast in The Wire are just actual Baltimore people.
Mm-hmm. Which again is going to the corruption. I wish honestly, like they'd done more with the police, because that's kind of my reading to Cyrus is like, this is Cyrus versus his brother Atraxerxes. Mm. Shouldn't the police have more other than actually killing one of the members by throwing him in front of the train because he had beef with the director? shouldn't there be a little bit more to that? Like the police woman is the only other one we see interacting. Mm-hmm. And she isn't out for Ajax. Ajax just is stupid enough to fall into the trap. So there's so much there that is both humanizing of the gangs, but is not going, other than Cyrus's speech, to like the bigger problem of like, why do these gangs exist mm-hmm. in the first place within the city?
In the book, the cops are way more effective. Like mm-hmm. they lock up tons of these guys, and that is the main pressure they face on their way journey back. They have encountered with one other gang, just like Mercy, that scene. Happens, but it plays out very differently. There's only one of them, and he's clearly kind of trying to buy time during the negotiations to get more of his men to show up. But they go to their neighboring gang that they war with at the end. They make it to their turf and they wreck the place and they shout for them to come out and they never come out. So mm-hmm. there's just not this gang fighting, and it's much more the cops and the straight world, like kind of pushing down on them kind of thing. That's the bigger threat.
But I think that's part of what makes the movie, again, to go back to it, I think we've done a really good job of trying to rehab it as social commentary. But when you look back at it, like, I mean, it is still pretty f***ing absurd, right? Yeah. All the gangs with their different, like their colors or purple sequin jackets. Where Tim and I, are we supposed to read the warriors as wearing like indigenous American outfits?
I read it as, yeah, like right? There's like a lot of like Native American motifs going on with their ensemble.
Right. And then like you were supposed to believe like eight of them are going up against like 40 of the other gang. Like throughout, there's this weird stuff that I don't know what to do with. Like, you know, Tim, you tell me it was popular and it made a ton of money, but it seems pretty absurd. Right, these gangs, and they're really sort of superficial.
There's no chance he'll listen to this. So my brother-in-law he's the right age to probably have seen this as a teenager, a young teenager, but a teenager. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, the guy can quote you the entire movie practically. And like, it clearly is very real to him, you know, like to me, it was like this sort of, I mean, I saw it in the 90s and it was like sort of this quaint, like, oh, I'm kind of giggling at what mm-hmm. my friend's oldest siblings kind of dug, you know, like that kind of thing. At least the first viewing. I've had different encounters since, but I think the action is pretty legit for the time in terms of like, there's not a lot like other than say Kung Fu movies, which were around and very popular. American action movies didn't typically have a lot of fist fighting this way, not like with larger numbers of people. And then you got all that imaginative kind of costuming. I mean, I think mm-hmm. it has like some reality to it, but then it's also taking you into a sort of fantasy version of all of it. Right. So I think it plays a pretty smart game that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, I think maybe my perspective on like what a realistic gang movie is like has changed because I think I was a teenager, early teen when Boys in the Hood first came out. And that was mm-hmm. a movie everybody watched. And I wonder, you know, what will our kids think of that movie? Will they think it's ridiculous and racist in the same way that we would about parts of the world?
I wonder that this is a sort of a question of like, because I feel like somewhere like this seems like the kind of movie that, you know, in this era of remakes and legacy sequels and prequels and all that, like this almost seems like a kind of movie that might get like sort of dug up from the grave and put it. But then I was like, well, could you ever do that? Like, I'm not sure what a 2020 Warriors movie would look like, just because our relationship to all of these things like policing, gangs, inner city violence have like changed and evolved so much in the intervening almost 50 years.
I think the proliferation of guns both in real life and in action movies would make this, it's sort of like it could only have happened when it did, because like you hit the mid-80s and gangs are heavily involved in drug dealing and they have way more money and resources, so mm-hmm. guns are much more commonly used. Like, you know, you get the crack cocaine explosion, you get all the shooting. And like, if you made a movie now, I can't imagine them having these gangs limited to fist fights and like fighting with improvised
bats,
which makes it much more interesting than it would be. I think it would just be like just tons of gunplay. I don't know. And it would mm-hmm. be hard to believe that, you know, with that gunplay, you weren't seeing the cops coming down on them a little bit fast. I don't know. People do that though. You could make it. I'm sure you could make it, but I don't know.
John Wick.
Yeah, I mean, it would be something. It'd have to be something like that, right? Yeah. It would have to be like just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that this whole underworld that we don't even know about. Because I guess that's also the element. It's like, you know, when the sun goes down, like this other dimension, this other world comes to life.
Well, I think that's where this film fails compared to its source material. Was like the whole point, as Colin was talking about earlier, is like the Greeks are presented with a problem and they come up with solutions. And the solution is not fighting all the time. It's, you know,
escape. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit in this film. Like, I think the escape element is there. And like when you split apart, when you try to meet up, but there's not a lot of negotiation happening either. Like all of the things you would need, fighting, knowing when to escape, knowing how to negotiate, like that's kind of the whole point for Xenophon, right? Is to explain what a good leader is. And that's kind of lost in this film.
And I think
Americans are much less interested in negotiation than ancient Greeks. That's all. Sorry, Joel, right. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm just thinking about that. I was searching. It looks like someone is trying to launch a miniseries prequel of the Warriors. Sorry, I'm on IMDb.
They're going to set it up. Five, so it'll make sense.
No, but like to go back to what Christy was saying, like with the ethnography, with the journey, like I think you could make a series. So I wouldn't pitch it as a movie. I would say if we're going to redo the Warriors, we need to do a Lost style backstory heavy journey with no Tim.
Me out. I don't need all that time. Give me one good 2-hour movie over a TV series any day of the week. I don't know. I'm not a patient man.
I like that idea for like, because like to me, Cyrus was the most exciting part with that whole speech and the vision he has. And the fact that what do you say? It's like 9 delegates from every gang in New York. Is like, how do you pull that off?
Right, but also steal a page from like The Departed or something else and give Cyrus a counterpart who's actually in the NYPD, right? Mm-hmm. And or who's like running for mayor or some BS like that. You know, then you can do the Wire thing. And Tim is still like, this is not fun enough, right? But
It's not, I am just an impatient person and I don't have faith in Siri's abilities to actually deliver on the promises that they have. That's all it is. I'm just a movie guy. That's just what it boils down to. I don't trust creators, showrunners to actually deliver, because what they do is they start it nice and then they end it poorly.
Are you thinking of Lost again?
I'm thinking of everything. I don't do series TV anymore, really. I'm a weirdo crank who watches old movies now. I hate to say it, I become my brother, but I did. I have an older brother who went the same way. It's a sad fate, really. But
shows that have a clear ending, like a clear arc, work a little better, like Breaking Bad. Right. Mm-hmm. But I think what we'd miss with the show, because I think we've already all anticipated that it would be gritty and realistic. And what I think made us love the movie, Tim, or at least remember it fondly, is some of its absurdity and fun. Yeah. Right. I mean, the opening speech of Cyrus, the weirdness of the villain, the strangest of, like, look at this ridiculous gang. Look at that one. Like, why do they have this hideout with all this bats, all these bats in it? Like
roller skates so and yeah. overalls.
Yeah, what's the deal with the guy at the roller skates in the subway?
Gang is called the Punks, which is the part I could never figure, because they don't seem very punk to me, but...
Yeah, 79's a little... I mean, maybe it's when it was written. I don't know when it was written. I mean, you figure the word punk being used for, like, what we think of as punks is only a few years off. Yeah. I mean, like, I think it's only 3 years before that movie came out. You know, it's very... And I don't know how much people in California... Well, they... You know what? The germs were out. I don't know. They could have used that better. It's a weird choice.
Part of it is since all the gangs are so strong in their theming and their ensemble and their coordination, and that gang seems a little, I don't know what their thing is other than overalls and like rugby shirts.
I always just think of them as like the most violent version of Dexy's Midnight Runners on roller skates. That's like my vision of what they are. Right. They're just like the Irish immigrants or something. I don't know, man.
Or punks like football fans, or what's the term for football?
Like a hooligan?
Well, hooligans. Yeah. That
oh,
element.
Yeah.
They should have put some football hooligans in there, like have them imported over.
Yeah.
You know, you just have Carmen Sandiego come on that radio and be like, you know, we've got the Welsh hooligans in from the airport.
Yeah, it feels like a joke from Airplane or something like that, where it's like, here's this randomly French gang or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Just go crazy.
Yes. The mime should have been French.
Yes.
And look at a lost opportunity.
Nowadays, you could do this. You could have like the cosplayers. Mm-hmm. Like, you could have some fun with some of these themed gangs.
I think this could actually work as an animated series, too, because then you can keep all of the somewhat silly elements of the different gangs and their caricatures, but you could still have it grittier, like how they do some of the Batman, you know, animated shows and things like that. That could work if you wanted to keep both elements.
Or go the other way and make it more friendly for children. That's where I started going. I'm like thinking like, oh, like Avatar The Last Airbender, like that age group.
And hey, Avatar The Last Airbender did genocide, so why not?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I'm serious. That wasn't a joke. I'm like, that would be an interesting way to take it, because that could be a way, too. You probably have less guns because of, like, that automatically ups your ratings, I think, if you have, like, real-life guns, right? So you keep it to fistfights and stuff.
The way ratings work in modern media is fascinating, and we don't have time for it to get it. But just things like one of the things that I didn't notice until someone pointed out is, like, in the last couple of years, smoking, our attitude towards smoking in movies has changed, like, dramatically. Mm-hmm. We're like, today, like, smoking a cigarette on screen is a guaranteed R for your movie. And so there's things like, so in the most recent Batman movie, Colin Farrell was like, oh, the Penguin should have a cigar, right? Like, that makes sense that like my character would smoke. And they're like, no, we can't do it because like the movie has to be PG-13. Like, these are our marching orders, so you can't smoke a cigar, even though the movie is about like drug trafficking and criminal corruption and like and all sorts of horrible stuff. But the smoking puts it over the edge. I have two questions kind of to, if we're, anyone's got other sort of things they want to get out there.
I have one final fun fact too. You know, that whole dialogue of where Mercy got the coat? That is because she has a cast on from the scene where they're being chased by police and the guy is pushed into the front of the train. She broke her wrist because the actor didn't let go. So they had to like remove her from the film for a bit and then put a coat on her. And she's in a cast for the rest of that movie.
But I never know. Wow.
Oh, it kind of works because it is. It's like, where'd you get that coat? She's like, I stole it. And he's like, all right.
That's okay.
So talking, we kind of talked just to bring it back to, because Joel mentioned, I kind of want to just circle back around the idea of like bringing it back to the premise of, you know, this podcast and like connections with antiquity, and that the Greek connection in this film and in this book very much feels more like just a trapping or an excuse to kind of give it some sort of sense of legitimacy. But then as we were talking, we kind of are piecing out, there are these parallels. Like, are we, like, I don't know, what do we think about the sort of connection with its quote unquote original source material? And is the connection that we're making imagined? Is it real? Does it add a layer of meaning to this text? Or I don't know. That's a big question, but I just wanted to come back to that one before we departed.
So, I mean, my general sense is that audiences make meaning, not authors. Mm-hmm. So I don't really care what the intention was in the beginning. But I think that, you know, it's mostly that there are limited numbers of functioning narrative patterns, and that we're drawn to see the comparisons because we're invited to it. And it's exciting and everything, but I think, you know, the core sort of, I mean, you could compare it to the Odyssey in a way if you wanted to, and probably get as much out of it if you're dealing with gender issues and travel and like mm-hmm. complex men as the central figures, right? Mm-hmm.
The Lizzie's is like
the sirens.
Or I was thinking of, remember, I never studied, so why can't I think of her name? Circe, thank
the
you.
The Lystragonians? Yes. Oh, yeah. No,
I was thinking of like, although, you know, Xenophon does mention the Odyssey in his book. So just, you know,
I'm sure Xenophon was probably thinking of the Odyssey when he was there.
Sure he was.
Right, so I just think like it's one, a testament to sort of, you know, a narrative effect, how effective narrative patterns work. But then it's also, on the other flip side, it's a testament to the cultural cachet still of any association with the classics. Right. Yeah. So I'll say this is Xenophon, and then suddenly it will legitimize it for those few people who might mm-hmm. not be drawn in just enough by the titillation of crazy gangs from New York.
Yeah.
I would say I do think that the plot hook, I totally believe that Sol Yurick was like, thought of that, bringing that hook in of like having these guys on the other side of essentially for the world for them. You know, mm-hmm. is, you know, you're on Coney Island, the other side of the world is the South Bronx. Like that's yeah. like not hardly unique to him, but like it is a cool way to do it. And I believe he probably was inspired by it. And there's evidence in the book. I it's funny, when I read the book initially, I was like, I don't really see any connection. And then as I'm listening to more and more of the Nabis, I'm like, no, okay. Maybe he was, you know, maybe he's a little bit in the afterward being a little bit of self-deprecating or not being too serious about it. I mean, I think ultimately Joel's not wrong. It's mostly a story inspiration, and it could have come from something else, right?
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I think it a little bit more strong. But then I never have fully agreed with Joel that the author's intentions don't matter. So to bring up an old grudge, old argument, but you know, no, I don't know.
And this goes back to like something Colin said, that I, you know, that this was one of the first things you translated in Greek class, because it's very straightforward, third person, mm-hmm. and that in comparison, Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars are the same for Latin. And, you know, Caesar did that very intentionally so that that could be proclaimed on the streets for propaganda to make him popular. And I was kind of curious if Xenophon is also trying to do something similar with very accessible language and telling this war autobiographical story. And then
he does put himself in the third person.
Yeah. And then, you know, does this film, I don't think they're going for political positions or anything like that by creating this film, but is there an attempt to make it very accessible but have this weird veneer of highbrow legitimacy at the same time, because there's reference to a Greek author? Like that moment once again in the subway where you have the prom kids and the gang kids all in sharing the same train for a moment, and then you just kind of continue on with the story.
Imagine if you'd had a peek into her purse and it had a student's edition of Xenophon in it.
Yeah.
Which that's in the book. I mean, the book, the kid's reading the comic, right? And I think Sol Yurick, his intention probably, you know, you make a good point. He was a communist, or his parents were. I forget which, but he had been a social worker. He's definitely very left. And I think he may have had more of a goal like that. I think he wanted to make he did, like you said, he was frustrated with things like West Side Story's depiction, and he wanted a real depiction. And I think, you know, that's where this book, the afterword talked about his reaction to the movie, you know, speaking of the author's intentions or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he was like, essentially, like, he could have had an independent filmmaker make it. Apparently one wanted to, he doesn't say who. And then this happened instead. And he was kind of like, you know, it's too Hollywood. It's mm-hmm. too fantastic. It's not what I wrote. But, you know, at least his daughter, who was 14 at the time, got bragging rights. That was kind of his which was great. He's like, because I can totally see it. Absolutely. Like, that movie came out. Your dad, you were 14 in New York and your dad wrote it. I'm sure you're like, yeah, my dad wrote The Warriors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think you both bring up really good questions, though, about how we view an author and their place in the world and how seriously we take their work. Right. Because everybody, not everybody, mostly were like, all right, Julius Caesar was doing his propaganda thing about Julius Caesar. But Xenophon the Anabasis, I don't think anybody knows what he's trying to do, because he's a really enigmatic author. Right. Like, he has his, you know, Memorabilia of Socrates, which most people ignore, but it's filled with chock full of stuff. He has wrote the first biography in the history of the Western tradition, as far as we can tell, with the Agesilaus. And, you know, he also wrote on, like, horsecraft. Like, he's a really weird guy who's been thoroughly under theorized because he writes simply and he's not Plato, right? Yeah. I'll just put it out straight like that.
Thank God
he's not Plato. No. So, I mean, I would be open to him being more complex, just as I think Tim's corrective about taking the author a little more seriously of The Warriors is there. And then we have to ask about that weird relationship between the book and the movie. Right? Is the movie just salacious to make money, or does it actually act as, to use another terrible metaphor, a Trojan horse, of using this like overarching fun material to get us talking or thinking about the other stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much in concurrence. And I just had one other sort of passing thought, which is just, and I only say this because we just were so recently talking about The Wire. One of our guests has a whole elaborate thing about The Wire as kind of Iliadic, but the like this broader notion of like the juxtaposition of particularly like Greek tragic forms or in Greek literature more broadly with inner city like poverty and gangs and crime and things like that, which like in particularly American like inner city stories, and in the way that it sort of feels like on the surface level, it's like those are the most sort of incongruous things. We have like the highest of highbrow literature and the kind of lowest of the lowbrow kind of stuff. But like in another way, and like that the general impulse to like see a connection there of these like larger dramatic arcs or narratives or characters or things like that. And I don't really have a point to this other than just noting that it seems to be a thing. Maybe starting here, but I'm not sure.
I mean, West Side Story is doing the same thing, right? I mean, West Side Story is taking Shakespeare and it's putting it into a New York City gang. I mean, I think we could probably, can we blame Orson Welles for all this with his, I think that's set in Africa or Haiti. It's Haiti where he did on stage. He did, I want to say Macbeth, but I know he also did a movie version of Macbeth. So I forget which Shakespearean play he did this way, but he did with an all black cast in the 30s. And I believe it's set in Haiti. I don't think it's set in New York at the time. So maybe it's not quite there, you know, but, and I don't know if he's the first person to go, let's take Shakespeare and then stage it. I don't know enough about theater history in a million years to say if he did that first. So I'm probably, but definitely West Side Story is a great antecedent for this. And what a different, you know, change to take that sort of highbrow literature and put it into, I don't know, is it really more like Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and Plutarch? I don't know, but.
Well, and, I mean, so much of Greek theater was not highbrow, neither was Shakespeare. Oh, it was tongue in cheek, and we mm-hmm. have turned it highbrow in our minds because it's old language and, oh, you have to translate it. Oh, no. Well,
and, you know, what I'm thinking about is how is it a particular type of racialized reception? Right. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned, you know, so Molière is in a way a reception of comedy, right? Even Roman and Greek comedy. But so how does the visual form of the stage and the screen coupled with the racial dynamics of the U.S. and Europe change the sort of process of reception, right? So, you could look at it one side, is it patronizing, right? Is it uplifting? And it really depends on who's doing the work and who's watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, that was a downer.
No, but I think you're totally right.
It's 100% true, though. Yeah. I mean, like, you know.
Like, if a white artist did Chirac, mm-hmm. right? If it was all white producers and stuff, like, 30 years ago, people would be like, oh, that's cool, right? Look at what they're doing. But now we'd be like, well, that's pretty racist stuff. But when it's coming from a community and it's engaging critically with the tradition, then it becomes a dynamic reception.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I think all good reception at some level really seeks to replace what came before or destroy it. Mm-hmm. And I think that especially given our cultural dynamics, that sort of powerful interplay.
I sign off on that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. I had one, my final question that I was hoping we could sign off on, which was, if you were to be in one of these gangs, which gang would you be in?
Oh no.
I think the Lizzie's is the only one I'm allowed in, as far as I can tell.
Or if you were to start a gang, what would you
see? Okay, so which would people put us in, or which would we want to be in?
Would you want to be in, right? You create meaning. As you say.
Okay. Man, I mean, look, I've got a main character syndrome, so I'd probably want to be in the Warriors. But in real life, look at me. I'm a white guy, ridiculous white guy. I'd probably be on roller skates and in suspenders.
I was honestly, that's where I was going with it too. I'm like, those guys, their outfit just cracks me up every time I see them, you know. But God, yeah, I don't know. I also always, I'm trying to think of some of the background guys at the front at the start, because some of those guys are so much fun.
The one
to look
that caught
at.
My eye was the Electric Eliminators. I don't know what
I was about to say them, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm like, look, I mean, I'm only with my hair color when I was younger, the dark hair. I feel like it's not curly enough, but I feel like I could be like, I feel like that was an Italian American gang. I don't know for sure, but I'm like, that's my only hope of fitting in. Maybe is to be like, I'm going to emphasize the quarter of me that fits with you. But also, I like that 50s into the 70s aesthetic, because mm-hmm. that's Electric Eliminators. Those guys are totally like, we're wearing yellow shiny jackets. Like, it's a very, it's a very like 50s street gang meets 70s revival of 50s junk. So mm-hmm. I think that entertains me. But I don't know. I'd like to be with my old roommate in the punks with the overalls and the stripe. I feel like I've lived in Boston long enough that somehow feels Boston to me. I don't know why.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, like they would be like, I'm like, they would be like the Patties or something like that.
Yeah, they definitely, they listen to the Pogues and drink Guinness.
Exactly. Yes, it's like, exactly. I think they can understand where they're going to go, right? but if I could make up my own, I'm always like this. I got to have three answers to everything. I'm trying to think of like something that is alliterative with library cart, like, you know, the cart or something. You know, we all have like library carts decked out with spikes.
Like, yeah, get some Mad Max on it.
Like, And you're like big fine stamps of doom.
Maybe I join like the professors or lexicographers and we just throw dictionaries at people. About, you know, and when one of us died, it would be immolated on a pyre of Liddell and Scott.
I guess I'd want a version of the Lizzies, but considering I have three cats, it's like we'd be the crazy cat ladies. And then that would, there we go.
Yeah.
Are you willing to throw them at people Simpson style?
Yeah, I was about to say, are you going to turn to the Simpsons?
No, I'm thinking like more of the style of the, what is it, the Crab Eater or whatever in House of Dragons, where you just tie them to a post and then put cat pate on them and then have the cats come chew on them.
I think, what's that movie, Tim, we watched about the guy who controls rats?
Willard.
So maybe the cat ladies could like send commands to their cats.
There's a Mexican ripoff of Willard called Night of the Thousand Cats. That's about this crazy dude. He's really more like, he's a serial killer, and he keeps he keeps 1,000 cats in a cage, and he puts his victims in there with them. And I watched it at the height of pandemic. I'd heard of it for years, and I found it streaming on like Tubi or something. And I'm like, that's it. I'm finally watching this stupid thing. I've been making jokes about this for 20 years, and it does have the most remarkable scene where a dude shows up in a helicopter, and he's like, he lands, I think, or does he might even talk to her megaphone. He like picks her up and she goes with him. And then you find out she's married and has like a kid, and she takes the kid with her to this meeting with this guy. It is the weirdest. It's not worth watching for anyone, but I'm glad I did, because that stuff, I was like sitting there like, girl, don't go in that helicopter. You don't go in a helicopter with a strange man. I'm pretty sure my dad would have told me not to do that. As an adult male, he would have been like, don't go in a helicopter with a strange man, Tim. He did used to give me advice that was right out of the 65 Warriors book about like improvised weapons. He'd be like, Tim, if you're ever in a fight, get yourself a metal garbage can lid. I'm like, Dad, it's even in 1989, there's no metal garbage can lids left. He's like, you can rip off an antenna off a car. And I'm like, I don't think those would do damage anymore, Dad. You know, yeah, he had a whole list of improvised weapons. So I'm reading The Warriors and I'm like,
get your hands on a Coke bottle.
Apparently my dad was in the gang in 1958 or something. I don't know. Like, or he knew guys who were.
I was gonna say, if you go to state parks, they still have metal cans, but they're chained to the trash can. So like,
oh yeah.
Especially to stop Tim's dad from doing that.
You can block it. You can block a knife with it. You can throw it. You can hit somebody with it. Yeah. He's like going on all the, I'm like, throw it. Am I Captain America, Dad? What is going on? And Joel's met my dad. It's a plausible thing. He probably could have thrown it and hurt somebody with it, but not his son.
He could have killed a man with his eyes closed with a garbage can, like, without a doubt.
It's a crazy person.
All right. I think that's all I got. I think maybe we should end it on the story of Tim's dad. Tim, Joel, thanks so much for coming on the show. Hope you guys, this wasn't a complete waste of your Thanksgiving break.
Happy to be here.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for having me.
If listeners want to see, read, hear, get more of you, where can they do that?
Professor Mortis at Letterboxd. That's probably the film reviews. That's probably where you want to find me.
Oh, I should follow you on Letterboxd.
And on Twitter, if it's still here.
Yeah, we're on Twitter if it's still around, but I have a website, sententiintqui.com.
Excellent. As usual, you can find more Movies We Dig at our website, movieswedig.com. Again, if it exists, you can find us on Twitter. At Dig Movies, and you can find the podcast on most major streaming services, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff. Tim, Joel, thank you again so much for coming on. I had a blast. And well, if ever you have any movies you want to talk about or get back in the mix, any even the thinnest connection to anything having to do with the ancient world, our door is always open. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you around. Bye.
Bye.